Welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern. Universities across Missouri could lose about an eighth of their state funding next year under a budget proposed by Governor Jay Nixon. With federal stimulus funds set to run out, lawmakers will have to reduce general revenue spending overall by about $500 million in the next fiscal year, which will begin July 1st. The governor recommended that about $105 million of that reduction should come from cuts to higher education. Meanwhile, the governor also expects to prevent colleges and universities from simply increasing tuition to make up for the lost funds. So, what's a university to do? Are there, as the governor suggests, millions of dollars in administrative efficiencies that could save taxpayer money? And if not, then how are the campuses going to deal with the latest drop in state funding? And how might those cuts affect the quality of higher education in our state? Joining me in the studio to talk over some of the options, first, Brady Deaton is the chancellor of the University of Missouri. That makes him the chief executive officer of the Columbia campus. Welcome to our program, Brady Deaton.
Thank you, Reverend. It's good to be here.
Glad to have you with us. We've been wanting to get you on the show for some time, and we're glad that this is an issue that aligns with your schedule and a good one to have you talk about as well. Paul Wagner is also with us. He is the deputy commissioner of the Missouri Department of Higher Education. He oversees budget issues for the department. Welcome back on our program, Paul Wagner.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have a chance to follow up on our State of the State coverage from 2 weeks ago and get a little more in-depth in some of the issues that came up that night. We also hope that you and our audience will join our conversation. Do you agree with the governor's proposal to cut higher education funding, or would you rather see next year's state spending adjusted in some other way? Share your ideas. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start with this question. Paul Wagner, let's start with you. How big of a problem is this kind of cut going to be to the state's universities and colleges?
Well, it's a devastating cut. You know, there's really no way to sugarcoat it. And it would be a devastating cut even if it wasn't on top of previous cuts of the last couple of years. So, you know, looking at it as a one-year snapshot is difficult enough, but then to think about the two previous years where there were also reductions in state appropriations makes it that much more impactful. And then it's also important to note that during that time, our institutions, our public institutions, have really gone the extra mile to keep tuition in check. We had 2 years in a row of flat tuition while state appropriations were either flat or getting cut. And we really we were at the forefront of the nation in terms of keeping tuition low. So now you see you know, kind of holding our breath for that long on tuition and then having an additional significant cut in state appropriations on top of that creates a tremendous amount of pressure for the upcoming year.
Now, Chancellor Deaton, you sent out a letter to the university community last week talking about the historical perspective of this.
Yes.
Maybe you could give our listeners a sense of how this fits with what's been going on with funding for MU over the past several years.
Well, as to use Paul's term, it is a pretty devastating proposal this year for budget reduction of 12.5% in our budget, and that'd be about $21 million for our campus on top of the tremendous reductions that we've had really since 2001. We've had, we're not back to that level in state funding. And the proposed budget of the governor would put the University of Missouri back to about 1997 levels for our campus. And that's, and since that time, our enrollment has increased by over 50%. So we're educating a lot more students, building the future of Missouri and helping with the future of the nation. At a time when our budget is just under severe constraints. So it's important that people have that perspective. You cannot simply keep undertaking marginal adjustments. We've reached the precipice, you might say, in terms of what we can do, and it's going to take some very significant steps and steps that will hurt this university. We're totally dedicated to maintaining the quality of our instruction here for students at both the undergraduate, graduate, and professional levels. And to try to do that at a time when the budget's being attacked the way it is a challenge. And, of course, the ultimate impact on the budget will depend on what our Board of Curators decide to do with tuition and tuition and fees. And, of course, as you know, the governor is also very concerned, expressed concern that we do not go up very high on tuition. So it's sort of like we're trying to do everything with our hands tied behind our back, and that's an untenable way. We can't run a quality educational institution that way. So something has to give, and we're engaged in the process of communicating that as carefully as possible and enabling the public out there to understand where we stand and how difficult a period we're in right now.
Right. Well, let's talk about this idea the governor has that there are administrative efficiencies to be had. What do you suppose he's referring to there, and are there administrative ways to reduce the spending around the university in Columbia and the other state colleges and universities? Maybe, Paul, you start us off with the possibility of there being administrative places to cut.
Right. Well, you know, I'm kind of the administrator of a state department, you know, that's very small, especially compared to any higher education institution. And we always feel like there's always room to improve. There's always ways to get more efficient, to be more effective with the money we have. But, you know, the governor did not mean to imply that the entirety of this cut could be absorbed by administrative expenses. And his budget director said as much in front of the Senate Appropriations Committee last week that, you know, certainly that, you know, there's always room for improvement, but certainly that's not the answer. And, you know, they simply made this, the governor's staff has communicated that they had to make this cut because that's what was necessary to balance the budget. And if they had the money, they wouldn't have done it. So it's certainly not a situation where the governor is saying, you know, higher ed institutions have enough excess administrative overhead that they can simply absorb this cut that way. That's not what the governor is saying, and certainly that's not realistic by anyone's estimation. Now, there's a lot of things that we have undertaken, and as a higher education community, we've done an extensive review of academic programs that's resulted in the elimination of some academic programs that were undersubscribed across the state. And now institutions are working together to provide those programs in a more efficient manner. So there's certainly a lot of improvements that have been undertaken, and like I said, there's always room for improvement. But to think that you can absorb a 12% cut on top of the previous budget exercises simply through efficiencies like that is not realistic.
Okay, let me remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the governor's proposed cuts to higher education funding. With me in the studio are MU Chancellor Brady Deaton and Paul Wagner, Deputy Commissioner of the Missouri Department of Higher Education. For those of you in our audience, have you or someone you know felt the pinch of decreased state funding on higher education over the last few years? If so, what was the impact that you saw or heard about? Share your experience. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can join our online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Chancellor Deaton, there have been cuts over the last several years.
Yes.
What do you think is going to happen if the budget goes through this way? Where are some of the areas that MU might see reductions?
Well, let me say it really would not be within the realm of reality to talk about such a budget reduction as this being addressed through administrative reductions, because in fact we have placed reductions in administration and trying to create efficiency of operations for the last decade in trying to achieve the budget balance at a time when students are growing significantly, and a time, I would point out, that federal and state compliance regulations are requiring more and more funds being diverted to what may be classified as administrative issues or administrative personnel, but in fact are necessary to keep the university going. So the research animals, for example, have standards by which they must be taken care of in any major research university. And so that often gets translated into administrative personnel, when in fact it's mandated by law and you really don't have any choice. We've been achieving enormous efficiencies at our university, and that's evidenced by national data that will show that the University of Missouri devotes a smaller proportion of its budget to administration as compared to its primary mission of teaching, research, and outreach. Then we're in the lowest percentiles of the nationally of American doctorate institutions. So we are a very efficient operation by any measure. We've achieved about a 28% increase in efficiency as best we can measure it over the last 10 years. And under the kind of budget constraints we've had and with the kind of continued demand for quality instruction that we have sought to achieve, We've reduced and stripped down just about every office we can in the university to its bare minimum. In fact, to the point where we've gotten into trouble from time to time because we simply don't have the personnel to keep some of the critical operations going. So we can't be irresponsible. I mean, it's easy to use rhetoric in this regard, but we can't be irresponsible. And so when you look at where we're going, what we're going to have to do under the budget situation today, it's not a pretty picture. Because we need instruction in the classroom. We are a member of the Association of American Universities, the AAU, which is the most prestigious group of universities in the nation because of the depth and comprehensiveness of our educational programs, and particularly our research program. So there are only 34 public universities that are in this group. It's very important, and our research effectiveness is critical to that. We have to have quality research being undertaken because our nation is in desperate need of research. We have to have the doctoral programs and professional programs that keeps us strong as a state and a nation. We are the university in Missouri, the single university in the state that has that responsibility.
And how much does the general revenue spending from the state support those research activities and other things as opposed to research grants and other outside funding? What's the breakdown there?
Oh, the principal research mission of the University of DeVoe is supported principally by external funding, competitive funding from National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, NIH, also from the Department of Defense, Department of Education, United States Department of Agriculture. Those are the principal suppliers of the funds that undertake research here. At the same time, and that represents around $150 million annually in funding. But we devote $75 to $100 million out of the state funds and general operation funds to support the research infrastructure. That includes support for a College of Veterinary Medicine, the College of Agriculture, Food and Natural Resources. Some of those funds are matched one-to-one with the state, with the federal government in a case of experiment station research and extension. So we get about, in that regard, about $16 million from the federal government just for those particular purposes. So the amount of funding that goes into those missions is still predominantly from external funding. Also funding from private foundations, private sector, from state agencies, and a myriad of national and, to some extent, international programs that help support that, frankly, help provide a quality education without the state having to pay for it. And that's very significant in terms of what this institution brings to the state, and it's vital for the economic development of the state. Our weekly payroll here is quite extraordinary, and it's a major source of funds that flow into the state to promote economic development, right, in addition to the knowledge base that is created.
Right. You mentioned the payroll. One of the things that a lot of people who live in Columbia have talked about regarding university expenses is the idea of faculty salaries not going up over the last few years. Last year, there was a 2% increase in the faculty salary pool,
right,
and they were talking about a 3% increase for next year. What's the prognosis for that?
Certainly, it will be questioned again right now, and that's a decision made by our board of curators. In this environment, I believe the governor's budget included a 2% increase for state employees. So, and to some extent, we look at that as a factor. And most importantly, we look at how we compete in salaries with the AAU universities, public universities in the nation. At this time, we are bottom of the 34. That concerns us a great deal because that's what Missouri as a state depends on, those quality individuals to generate the research ideas that lead to the startup of new private sector firms to create jobs for the future. And we have a series of those coming out of the work we've done. But if we lose those key faculty, we lose that potential for the state of Missouri.
And so are you saying if this budget proposal goes through that that 3% raise might not happen or that it might be a 2% raise in line with what state employees would get?
It may be modified, and that would be a decision our board of curators will have to make. And they're meeting later this week, and I'm sure we'll be addressing that issue.
Yeah, on the issue of faculty salaries, I'll offer a perspective from Jefferson City. I completely agree with what Chancellor Deaton's saying about the importance of the faculty salaries at the University of Missouri and especially the retaining of the quality, talented faculty. But I'm going to appear in front of the House Appropriations Committee in a couple days, and then we'll be in the House Budget Committee. And there is not a less compelling reason that I could bring in front of that committee to ask them for more money than to provide faculty salaries. That falls on the deafest of deaf ears in my experience in Jefferson City. That first of all, I'll be shocked if we state employees actually get our 2% raise. I'm very excited for it. I'm not going to spend it yet, though.
Yeah.
But really, it's been more on the opposite side, where the committees have grilled us, and they were on the universities as well. You know, did you give raises this year? And the answer they wanted to hear was no, because they see the unemployment rate, they see a lot of people working part time who'd like to be working full time, and they just feel like, in this kind of economic environment, it's better to not, that it's not necessary to give raises to retain employees, and mostly their point of view is not, they're looking at Department of Social Services or Department of Mental Health or Department of Corrections and looking at those kinds of things, and a lot of times the completely different employment dynamic that Chancellor Deaton's talking about the university kind of gets rolled up in that same ball of wax. So I anticipate really rough sledding for the governor's recommendation for 2% for state employees, and I don't envy the curators for having to do this kind of balancing act with the competing demands on the money and the need to retain faculty and staff.
Let me flip that around. You said that the salary issue doesn't gain traction. What does gain traction when you go before legislative committees and you're talking about funding for higher education? Mm-hmm. What are the things that make them reconsider cuts or make them think maybe we need to be a little more generous in that area?
Well, part of it is there's a limit to what they would like to do and limit to what they can do. And to some extent, people like myself and university staff who are down there advocating for higher education, at some level, you're begging a homeless person. You're asking someone for money who has no money. So it's hard to even say, well, what has gotten traction? There hasn't been a whole lot that's gotten traction simply because the state has been broke. But, what resonates is to talk about the economic development angle that, Chancellor Deaton mentioned, providing a more educated workforce, a higher level of educational attainment among the Missouri citizenry is really the engine for economic development in this state. That's, frankly, the argument that every person who comes in front of a committee makes, be it the lottery or tourism or whatever that's coming asking for money. And I think the particular challenge that higher education has in that respect is that investment in higher education is a little bit longer-term investment than it would be to do, immediate tax credits or to do lottery advertising or something like that, that someone would say this is going to turn around and allegedly turn around a return for the state immediately.
Right.
So that's really what we try to talk about is how, when businesses are looking to relocate here, when businesses are looking to expand here, the number one thing they're typically looking for is there a citizenry that's educated? Is there a workforce that will support our operations? And not just mean to do a particular job that I have today, but who's going to be able to help me think strategically about my company? Who's going to help me think about how to grow? Who's going to be a creative problem solver? And that's really what higher education is all about.
Right. It gets to a question that came in from someone in our online chat room. Is there a multiplier used for investment impact in higher education? So, for example, for every dollar invested by the state in higher education, it generates X. Is there some way to calculate that or some number that's used?
There are ways of calculating, and we've done that many times. We generally use economic multipliers because a payroll here in Missouri, I believe the payroll of the University of Missouri is about $16 million per week. So that's a significant investment in the state. There's an immediate multiplier of roughly two to one in a direct impact. And then more importantly are the indirect impacts that occur through spending and respending in the state. And then, of course, the most important impact of all is a long-term return on the research that's done at the university, which pays off over a period of 5 to 15 years. And there's also been important national and international studies done of those returns, and we have a pretty good understanding of the kind of impact that has, and it's profound. And I think to go back to the point that Paul was making a moment ago about the public's understanding of the power of education, it's an area where we need attention and we need discussion because Missouri appears to have more difficulty in making those decisions than do most other states in the country. We're lower in support of education per capita or per student than any of the southeastern states. We just recently joined the SEC, and it's a compelling figure to look at that and realize that we're just out of line with the investments being made in education by those states. If you look at all the surrounding states to Missouri, they're all providing much more per capita to higher education than is Missouri. The next state up the line would be Illinois. They provide 50% more per capita than does Missouri. And the highest among surrounding states is Nebraska, and they're more than double what's provided in Missouri. So I think if you'll look very long term at that, you'll start seeing a pattern of economic development that's not playing to Missouri's best interest. And that's that. We lament that because the citizens of Missouri deserve better than that. The university began in 1839 as a real frontier attempt to stimulate higher education on the frontier of the United States, just after Thomas Jefferson purchased this territory from France. And we helped create many of the universities in the western United States. And I had a recent conversation with Vartan Gregorian at the Carnegie Institute. I don't think you'd mind me quoting him here. As we had breakfast one morning, he was musing over the national situation. He said, "You know, it's bothersome that the United States taught the world the power of education, and now while the rest of the world has learned that lesson and is charging forward, we seem to have forgotten it and are moving in reverse."
I want to remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the governor's proposed cuts to higher education funding. With me in the studio are MU Chancellor Brady Deaton and Paul Wagner, who is Deputy Commissioner of the Missouri Department of Higher Education. For those of you in our audience, how important do you think it is to keep college tuition from rising? We're going to talk about tuition in a minute here. Give us a call. Share your thoughts. 573-882-8925. You can also email us at intersection@kbia.org. And we have a caller on the line. Joyce, are you with us?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for calling in, Joyce. What's your question today?
Well, I was just thinking back. Did the governor not propose a few weeks or a month or so back to borrow money from the state institutions of higher education? And I believe that plan was squelched pretty quickly. Is this new plan now a punishment for not loaning the governors the money?
What do you think?
No, I certainly wouldn't characterize it that way. I think, you know, at the time, what the governor was doing was he was looking at the options that he had to try to balance this budget. You know, he had a few weeks to until his State of the State when he had to, he had to release a balanced budget and decide how he was going to accomplish that. And I think, frankly, he said, "It looks like I'm going to have to cut higher ed, some kind of double-digit percentage. What options do I have besides doing that? Is there some creative idea out there that we can kind of work on that would prevent that kind of cut from happening?" And I think that was really the genesis of that idea to think about, would it be possible to take money out of some institution's reserve and kind of buy us a year or so, to get through and try to prevent this kind of cut from happening now. You know, it ran into a lot of difficulties with, you know, what is the true nature of an institution's reserve and its liquidity and all those kinds of things. But, you know, I certainly don't begrudge the governor for trying to come up with a creative idea, besides just having to institute these kind of cuts.
Right. Chancellor Deaton, anything?
Absolutely. Creative ideas should be looked at. This was a case, though, where I think there's real problems in defining what is a reserve. The university doesn't sit with a pile of money to do alternative things with. We have ongoing balances and planned investments. And what gets counted as a reserve are those carrying balances. If you haven't made the expenditure today, you're going to make it tomorrow or next week. But if it's not done today, that will be counted as a reserve. And, of course, for the university to have tried to take any of that money, do anything with, would have been undercutting the plans and the incentives and the intentions of the entire faculty and administration of the university for those funds that we use on an ongoing basis. Clearly, if we had any real reserves, we had been investing them in the tremendous underinvestment that we now have in maintenance and repair, for example, which is way below any of the targeted standards used in American higher education. We're even in our agreement with the legislature, we're supposed to be spending about 1.5% of our budget on maintenance and repair each year. We actually spend less than 1% because we simply don't have the money. Our salaries lag for the same reasons. We aren't hiring faculty. We have a tremendous deferral of hiring in the university right now because the budgets haven't been there. So the notion that there's really any reserve that could be moved around is something that I think took some understanding. And once that was understood, we went in different directions.
Right. Joyce, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I really did, because I thought if there was reserve money, why is it not available, quote, to use at the universities?
Right.
I mean,
okay, exactly.
The universities have reserve monies, but I understand from the chancellor just now that that's dedicated to future projects or ongoing projects, et cetera.
Right. Okay, great. Well, Joyce, thanks again for calling in. I
want
to move on. We've got a little time here to talk about the tuition side of this. So if funding is getting cut, the opposite side of that equation might be to try to increase revenues. And as a university, tuition is a way to do that. But the governor wants that held down too. So what is possible tuition-wise and what is not possible in terms of trying to increase the money coming in through tuition? Paul, let's start with you.
Well, I think that every institution takes the setting of tuition very seriously and does not want to raise tuition surely for the sake of raising tuition. They're looking at what kind of product, what kind of services can we provide to our students? You know, what are the demands that the students are making? I mean, we've been talking about the University of Missouri a lot. Here in Columbia, we've seen this amazing expansion of Moberly Area Community College, you know, tapping into a demand in this community for community college services. And I'm sure that they're making that balance between the kind of student support that's needed at that location versus what the tuition has to be to support that. You know, students want to come to higher education. Obviously, they're voting with their feet in large numbers all across the state. But students don't just want to attend. They want to complete. They want to earn that degree. And often in order to do that at this university or at Moberly Community College or anywhere else in the state, you know, there has to be support systems for academic advising, for counseling, for financial aid. I'm not even talking about the classroom necessarily. And really, investments in those types of services are often the difference between a student just attending and a student graduating. And when there are significant cuts, like we're talking about here, the first instinct is always to protect the classroom, to protect that core instructional experience. But it's equally important to support those other kind of student services that often are the main support for classroom success or can really contribute to classroom success. So I think it's really, you know, at its core level, it's really a balancing act between can we cut back on services, can we expand class sizes, can we do any of these things that will allow us to save money, or does it make more sense from the student's perspective, especially from the student who wants to be supported and wants to succeed, does it make more sense to pay a little bit more to maintain some of those services, to keep class sizes a little bit smaller? And that's really the balancing act there. And you know, it's a difficult chore, and it gets more difficult all the time.
Okay. Just a reminder again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the governor's proposed cuts to higher education funding. Joining me in the studio are MU Chancellor Brady Deaton and Paul Wagner, Deputy Commissioner of the Missouri Department of Higher Education. You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We also have an online chat going at kbia.org. Just follow the link for Intersection. We're going to take a quick break here, but we hope you'll join us after the break, so stick around. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the governor's proposed cuts to higher education funding in the state of Missouri. With me in the studio are MU Chancellor Brady Deaton and Paul Wagner, Deputy Commissioner of the Missouri Department of Higher Education. For those of you in our audience, do you have ideas for ways that colleges and universities in Missouri could save money? If so, share your ideas. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We were talking just before the break about tuition increases and the challenges with trying to make up some budget cuts with tuition increases. And Chancellor Deaton, I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about what's feasible in the world of tuition increases. What's realistic? What could be done? What can't be accomplished in that direction?
Well, the families, of course, of students and student borrowing and scholarships provide the funds for the tuition. And tuition plus the state budget is basically the operating budget of the university. So as we look at a reduction of a proposed reduction of 12%+ for the university, then we have to just say, gosh, what can we either we reduce in costs to try to keep the programs we have, and how much of that can we make up by proposed tuition increases? And at the same time, the governor and the president and many others have been trying to urge us to keep tuition down, and we join in that effort, let me say. So when we looked at a budget reduction of over 12%, we calculated very quickly it'd take somewhere 12% to 14% in tuition increase to offset that reduction. We then set about in this part of the planning process of the university to say, what can we do? Where could we reduce other programs? Where could we save? Where could we gain efficiencies? And we can do some of that because we're committed to that on an ongoing basis, as we have well demonstrated over the last several years. So we were able to come up with proposals that are below the 12% that we started out thinking about, but still well above the CPI, let me say. And each of the campuses of the university are going through that exercise, and we're making our proposals toward the end of this week to our board of curators. And ultimately, they have to assess that profile of reductions in other programs, reductions in the number of faculty, whatever it turns out to be, against what we will be asking students to help us pay to operate the university. I think it's important to recognize you have to have funds to operate a university. We're trying to provide one of America's top quality education as cheaply as we possibly can, as at a lower cost as we possibly can. But we aren't willing to sacrifice the quality, because that's what parents and students are asking for. That's what they're coming from all around the United States and around the world. We have students from every county in the state, every state in the nation, and from over 100 foreign countries. And that out-of-state tuition, fortunately, helps us resolve some of these budget difficulties. And fortunately, more and more students want to come to the University of Missouri. Our out-of-state applicants right now is greater than in-state applicants to our university.
Right. And one of the challenges is the constraint that the universities are working under, that they're not supposed to raise tuition beyond the consumer price index, right, which for next year means 3% would be the cap unless they get special dispensation from Paul, your organization,
right?
So how likely is it that if the Board of Curators comes back and says, okay, we want to exceed that 3% that is allowed under the state law, if we wanted to get a waiver of that, Paul, how likely do you think it is that they'd be able to raise tuition without getting penalized for that beyond a 3% increase?
Right. Well, I wanted to clarify real quick that for the listeners that institutions can set whatever tuition they want. We at the coordinating board or the governor or no one else can set a tuition for them. They can set whatever tuition they want. If they go over the CPI, then they're subject to a fine. They're not subject to that tuition being changed by anybody else. Only the curators in this case can set that. So, you know, when we get a request for a waiver of that penalty, you know, we will look at it on the merits that are presented to us by the institution. We went through this process last year. It's not a pleasant process. It's not something that we enjoy, because, you know, certainly, you know, it puts us in the position of balancing these same things that we've been talking about. You know, the desire to keep higher education accessible and affordable, but also to maintain the quality of the programs and the ability of students to successfully complete. So, you know, we'll look at every institution that comes to us for a waiver request on its own merits, and look at the case that they present, and we'll act accordingly.
Right. And what are some of the things that make it a compelling case to waive the penalty? I mean, what are things that campuses say that convinces the the people deciding that, that, okay, it's right. We're going to let them raise it higher than 3% or right. whatever the CPI is.
Well, there's a list of criteria that are set out in the law, and then the commissioner always sends a letter late in the calendar year to institutions to mention specific things that he's interested in assessing if waiver requests are to come forward. Certainly the historical trend in tuition compared to state appropriations is an important factor. Many institutions in the state, University of Missouri, Columbia, Moberly Area Community College, too, have seen significant enrollment increases, and that's certainly a factor as well. There are a lot of factors. Chancellor Deaton briefly mentioned the maintenance and repair situation, the facility situation, where we have underinvestment in maintaining the state's buildings as they are. We have an underinvestment in expanding square footage to meet student demand. So all these different kinds of factors go into the mix. I don't think it's been difficult for institutions to make that case. It doesn't necessarily make our job any easier, but there's certainly compelling cases out there.
Right. Ruben, I think it's worth pointing out that the tuition of the University of Missouri is below the average of the AAU public universities. It's below the average of the universities in the SEC, the Big 12, or the Big 10. So we're operating at a very low tuition rate relative to others. And there's even private high schools, many in the state, whose tuition is above that of the University of Missouri.
Okay. A question from our chat room that sort of follows up on what Paul was talking about in evaluating these requests to exceed the consumer price index. The question from the chat room, is there a state school that's also facing similar cuts that has figured out newer different ways of dealing with the problem as opposed to raising tuition? Are there other solutions out there that you've seen that are novel from some of the other campuses in the state?
I'm not necessarily privy to understand how institutions, how they're actually managing their budget and how they're getting by from year to year. Certainly there have been institutions who, we've had variable tuition increases over the past couple of years. We had the agreement that held tuition flat for a couple of years, and then last year we had some institutions kind of right at the CPI, some a little bit higher, some a little bit lower. And really that just speaks to the different financial positions that different schools are in. Some have had much more enrollment growth. Even within enrollment growth, lots of institutions have seen increases in the number of students who are coming to them unprepared for post-secondary work. It takes additional investment to get those students up to speed, to be ready to be successful at the college level. So it really is an individual campus, individual institution kind of situation. So it's kind of hard to talk about blanket cases that they're doing something particularly different.
Chancellor Deaton, your thoughts
on that? I've had a concrete example for MU that illustrates what Paul is saying, and it also illustrates the difficulty of dealing with this overall financial situation. If you look at the successful completion of $1 billion fundraising campaign for the University of Missouri, that is a mix of programmatic support, buildings, and endowments. So you see a lot of good things happening at the university, principally because people give to the University of Missouri. But in terms of our annual budget, that entire set of activities, it represents only roughly $40 million in annual budget to the university. And that's also targeted according to the area of the university that the donor has identified. So if you look at the overall operating budget and count that in, everything that we're doing to try to keep tuition down and costs down is after we have considered all the gifts that are coming in that, as I said, amount to about 40-some million. There's a lot of talk about, if we promote more economic development and gain licensing revenue or revenue from patents and commercialization of intellectual property at the university. Right now, and we do pretty well, the University of Missouri among all public and private universities is ranked somewhere between 20 and 30 among American institutions of higher education, which is pretty darn impressive. Yet that's only about $7 million a year in revenue. So it pales in comparison to what's being asked. We're asked to reduce by $21 million our operating right. budget here by the state.
Well, just to clarify, I mean, this sort of goes to the comment that came through the chat room. This is from David in the chat room. When choosing what to cut, MU should cut non-student programs, including faculty salaries. Since the students are the ones paying more and more, cuts should come from state programs like extension and economic development rather than ostensibly, I'm adding this on to the end of the comment, but the actual what goes on in the classroom. Would you agree with that? that those are areas ripe for cutting rather than not hiring more faculty or rather than things like that?
We have to trade all that off. The University of Missouri has an agreement with the federal government and receives a one-to-one to match on its core extension program. Most of extension budget is provided by external grants and contracts, not borne by the citizens of Missouri. Yet what it's yielding in economic development and youth development to the state is enormous. So we do have to trade that off. Students, for example, high school and elementary school students across the state who participate in 4-H club activities are stimulated to attend higher education, one of the goals of both the governor and the president of the United States, at a much higher rate than those who don't participate in those programs. Our extension programs in economic development alone added over 6,000 jobs, almost 7,000 jobs last year to the state's economy. So again, the trade-off is against, yes, trying to appropriately teach students in the classroom. And let me say, we're not suffering there. We're making sure that happens. So yes, if it came down to that, we would have to do something to deal with non-teaching efforts. But we have to maintain the mission of the state's only public research land-grant university. And that has many important dimensions that incorporates quality teaching but goes well beyond it to help the state in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the National Science Foundation has singled out the University of Missouri as one of the top 10 universities in the nation for utilizing these other strengths that are derived from these other funding sources to enrich the undergraduate education of our students.
And is that not a compelling sell for the governor and for legislators then? Because economic development, job growth, job creation, those are all hugely important to the legislators and to the governor at this point.
We think it's a compelling argument, actually, and we always are a little bewildered that it's not accepted more readily.
Paul, what do you think on that in terms of making that case for funding higher education as economic driver in these days of attempts to create jobs?
Right. Well, like I said before, you know, that's the case that everyone makes. That's the same case that people, you know, when you think about the other major demands on the state's resources, you're talking about K-12 education, higher education, the Medicaid program, and frankly, tax credits. So, you know, when you think about, for example, tax credits being one of the more fungible sources there, that's obviously the case for tax credits as economic development. That's the case that the K-12 community makes, early childhood community makes, that when the state provides money for this purpose, it's an investment in the future, it's an investment in economic development. So I certainly think it is a compelling case. It's just a compelling case in a lot of other areas as well, and it's really hard to distinguish, you know, one of those purposes from another.
Right. One of our listeners has just posted a link to the Huffington Post today that an article that has you quoted in here talking about the president's linking of this tuition issue to funding and trying to make that connection between funding institutions that hold their tuition in check. And I just wonder, you're quoted here supporting the idea that funding should be tied to tuition and that holding tuition down. Well, the president's message isn't inconsistent with the agenda we're pursuing in Missouri. It's good to see him put focus on the same things. And the president's proposal is that funding would be tied to how well a university attempts to hold its costs down. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your approach to that balance between funding higher education as all of the things that higher education is attempting to do and trying to hold that tuition down too, and the connection between those two things.
Right. Well, I guess the way that I look at it is there's no one that likes to raise tuition. You know, no one takes joy in that. No one thinks it's a good idea for its own sake. It's just a matter of, like you said, balancing those different needs. And certainly when I say that what the president's the concept that he's presented is not inconsistent with what we're doing in Missouri. In Missouri, we're doing much the same thing where we have a statute that is somewhat of a tuition constraint. We have this waiver process. But beyond that, you know, we have, you know, a group of community colleges that are clearly dedicated to affordability. We have our four-year institutions that clearly have led the nation over the past few years in holding tuition increases down. They're very aggressive in their use of tuition dollars to recycle into student aid to help needy students out. So when I say that you can leverage certain resources or certain money to help keep tuition down, I'm saying that's consistent with what we see across the state of Missouri in community colleges and the four-year institutions in a variety of different ways.
Okay.
Reuben, I think it's important to point out, if I read the president's speech correctly, that he also called on the states not to reduce their commitment to education so that this overall goal could be achieved.
Right. Okay, let me just remind everyone quickly, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the governor's proposed cuts to higher education and the implications of that if it goes through. With me in the studio are MU Chancellor Brady Deaton and Paul Wagner, who is the Deputy Commissioner of the Missouri Department of Higher Education. For those of you in our audience, what ideas do you have for funding college education in the future? Perhaps there are things that the people in charge are not seeing and you might be able to help them out. Give us a call with your ideas, 573-882-8925. You can also email us at intersection@kbia.org. We've been talking about the tuition part of this. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the future of higher education in terms of the business model itself. I mean, the state support has been dwindling for several years. Tuition, trying to hold that in check. The two of those together, it's a difficult balancing act. What's going to happen in the future if the universities are to maintain the same level of quality and the same product that they can offer the public at large with declining support from the state if that trend continues? Where's this going to go? I mean, is higher education in trouble as a business model, or is this just a temporary thing that we're seeing? Chancellor Deaton, we'll start with you on that.
I think there's some fundamental changes underway that would suggest that we need to look at our business model in a new way, and that is looking at more private sources of income. But we cannot move away in public higher education from that dependence on the public, and that's a philosophical issue. Universities began in this country basically to promote religious viewpoints and supported by churches in order to educate the children of the well-off and the rich who could help run our society. That changed in 1862 with the Morrill Act that created the land-grant universities, such as the University of Missouri, and gave them a special responsibility, and that was to ensure that there was access across all economic classes in our society to higher education, so that everyone could participate fully in this thriving democracy that we were trying to achieve. The federal government then, in addition to the land grants in 1862, gave additional research money with the Hatch Act in the 1870s, and then in 1914 created the extension support that we now operate under. And so we have research, teaching, and extension and outreach. And those are very much national initiatives that will require continued public support, whether it's at the federal, the state, and the local level. And we see that playing its way out. I think it's a matter of the public also recognizing the important feedback they get, the important return on investment that is so vital to the future economic development of our country. And if you look around the world, nation after nation has learned this, as Vartan Gregorian reminded me recently. Look at what China's investing in education. Look at what India's investing. And they're moving ahead at a very, very rapid rate of economic growth, greater than in the case of China, greater than a 10% rate of growth for the last decade. That's very substantial. That's more than a doubling of the GDP every 5-6 years. The United States right now is lagging. The state of Missouri is lagging. I don't believe the citizens will wait for another Sputnik moment. We hope it doesn't take that. There's a lot of thinking that it may take that sudden cataclysmic recognition of how bad we're suffering in terms of economic change to make for more investment in education. We are trying to enable everyone, our students and the public, to understand this issue and to now make the investment so we avoid that kind of cataclysmic change. But ultimately, it could very well happen with a change in world affairs, with a change in the socioeconomic stability of our own country. Our crime rates, our prisons, our problems in this country are growing at a rate that most of us are not very comfortable with. And we think education at all levels is one of the ways of addressing that set of issues and changing the allocation of those public dollars. Paul said it very well. Every public dollar is being competed for by a tremendous range of needs in our society. And so we need to assess those, modify them, and decide what investments today will avoid the public costs of tomorrow. And more police forces and more mental health facilities and more crime detection efforts are not what we're looking forward to in the future. And we need to make the investments in education to minimize those kinds of future investments.
Mm-hmm. Paul, your thoughts on that in terms of the financial picture for universities, the way they're currently structured, do you think that is where they're going to continue in the future, or do you think there need to be changes in the fundamental way higher education views its business model?
Well, I think what Chancellor Deaton talking about is kind of what I was thinking along the same lines, is that it's not a new phenomenon that we've seen the proportion of a given institution's budget switching from a higher percentage of state support to a higher percentage of in effect, private support, mm-hmm. whether that be students or whatever. So you're kind of seeing a reverse democratization of public higher education, kind of like what Chancellor Deaton's talking about. So, I mean, I think that the business model is already changing. It's already changing towards a more privatized system, back to where his comment started, where it was a luxury for the wealthy. It was easier for wealthy people to send their children there. Much more difficult for lower income people to send their students there, to send their children there. And that bridge was crossed by public investment, by taxpayer support, in the interest of having a broadly educated citizenry. And so that's the model that we're heading towards, is back toward the delineation between those who can afford to pay and those who can't. That's the result of public disinvestment. Should the business model change? I think we would agree that it should. I'm not exactly sure how to accomplish that. But if you would have gone back, you know, 10 years ago, when I used to work for the Senate Appropriations Committee, and I think about the conversations we had in 2000, 2001, the last recession that we had, and a lot of people said, you know, maybe these institutions will finally become more efficient. And then, well, what's the most draconian thing we can do here in 2002 to make these higher education institutions more efficient? Well, let's reduce the amount of state support they get. Let's restrain their ability to raise tuition, and then let's, in some cases, double their enrollment. Let's make them take a lot more students with the same amount of resources. Surely that would make them more efficient. And that's exactly what's happened. So I think, as far as pushing the business model towards more efficiency, as that's commonly understood, that has taken place. As we talked about earlier, I mean, that has taken place. The per student spending is much less than it was before, because the business model has changed in higher education. It has become much more efficient due to the constrained resources at the same time that the enrollment was going up. So what's the next business model? I fear it's what we're talking about here, unless there is some kind of major change.
Interesting.
Yeah, we feel so committed to the role, the mission that the public has bestowed upon the University of Missouri, and that is access, the land-grant mission, trying to ensure that everyone who really wants to come to the University of Missouri and is dedicated to excellence can achieve that and graduate with a degree, a highly valued degree from the University of Missouri. So we're committed to that. So out of our own funds, as we manage our growing enrollment and the increasing demand on an ongoing basis for the education of the University of Missouri, we have developed work-study plans that provide about $50 million annually in work-study operation and work-study opportunities for students. Then we provide, as I said before, about $100 million, a little over $100 million in scholarships for students here at the University of Missouri, just to enable them to take advantage of this opportunity. So in one sense, we're charging the students more tuition, yet we're giving it back to them and discounting that by over 20% to our students. But we're doing it in a way that tries to ensure that we achieve our enrollment goals of providing support for low-income students. We want a certain amount of very merit-based students here, and the kind of diversity of ethnic and religious and geographic differences that we have.
Right. One of the questions that has come up in the chat room, why is the majority of the legislature opposed to increasing taxes? This comment specifically focuses on the cigarette tax, the proposal to raise the cigarette tax and use some of those funds to help reduce these cuts to higher education. Why is it so hard for the state to we've talked a little bit about this already in the first half of the program, but why is it so hard for the state to decide, you know, we're going to try to swing that pendulum back toward publicly funding the model of education rather than continuing to push it toward that privatization direction?
Well, the first thing I would say about that is that when it comes to the leadership in the General Assembly right now, especially I would say that the budget leadership, they are supportive of higher education. You know, Senator Schaefer is the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. He absolutely is a supporter of public higher education. Representative Sylvie in the House, the House Budget Chair, Representative Kelly, the ranking member on that committee, are absolutely supportive of higher education. I'm hard-pressed, you know, to go back and think about when we may have had more supportive people in those positions. You know, it's a matter of the resources not being there. So to talk about the cigarette tax, you know, I think there's certainly a lot of legislators who are reflective of their constituencies when they say they are against tax increases. Specifically on the cigarette tax, they're probably looking at the last couple times that the cigarette tax was on the ballot and it got shellacked. So in some respects, I think there's a sense that the people have spoken, and therefore, you know, we're not going to continue to beat that horse again with the cigarette tax increase. Now, there is an initiative to put the cigarette tax back on the ballot in November that would directly benefit K-12 education and higher education. If the signatures are gathered and all that, then that will be on the ballot, and the people can choose to decide again. But, you know, really, raising taxes is something that the Constitution of Missouri does not put on the legislature and the governor. The Hancock II Amendment provides that aside from a small amount, any significant tax increase has to go to a vote of the people. So even if the General Assembly was inclined to raise the cigarette tax 50 cents or whatever it is, the ballot measures, they can't do that. They can vote to send that to the people. And I think that's why we see this initiative process going with tobacco tax, that it's not really a question for the politicians to decide under our Constitution.
Right. And is there a perception out there that academia is an elite institution and therefore doesn't need to be supported by everybody in the state? Is that a perception out there, or is that not a part of what drives the desire to not increase taxes to fund the university?
I can't speak for the public as a whole. Certainly for the parents that we talk with, they want quality education for the quality degrees they get from the University of Missouri. And they've been very supportive of the tuitions that we have had to charge. I think Paul said it correctly, that there is really a revenue issue in the state, and the state legislature and the public at large has to decide what is the level of revenue they want to generate to support what they are demanding as a public, as a society. We feel that education is one of those issues they should support, and they should support it significantly so that all elements of society here in Missouri have access to this education.
Paul, your thoughts on that?
I don't get the sense from the legislature that there's some kind of ivory tower based hostility. We've been talking a lot about the University of Missouri. You know, we have a group of community colleges in this state that geographically span the whole state. We've got a state technical college in Lynn, Missouri. We have open enrollment 4-year institutions in St. Joe and St. Louis, for example. So we have a variety of different types of institutions here, and I think that state legislatures, you know, this is kind of one of the opposites of the term limits, of which I'm not a fan, but term limits now, you get people who probably did have a child in college or who hasn't been in Jefferson City for a long time, and they are closer to their community, in the sense that they're more in touch with their community college, they're more in touch with the 4-year institution in their district. And I certainly don't get that sense from the General Assembly that they think that institutions are overstaffed or elitist or anything like that.
Okay. I have to cut us off there. Unfortunately, we're out of time. That's it for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Chancellor Brady Deaton and Paul Wagner, Deputy Commissioner of the Missouri Department of Higher Education. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. Today's Intersection was produced by Raymond Tungekar with help from Janet Saidi. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Leah Becerra. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive producers Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.